Today, as you know, we're going to be talking about the Julian Assange extradition hearing and his trial and the potential trial in the US. A couple of things to mention before Matt and Phil talk about their amazing work. One is, as you know, or many of you will know, that Julian is currently in Belmarsh Prison in the UK, which has been described as a British Guantanamo of sorts. It's for violent offenders, murderers, terrorists, that kind of thing. His bail was denied, and there are COVID cases, and there have been deaths from COVID in Belmarsh at the moment. Just to sort of give the parameters of this discussion, just to remind you, this extradition request for Julian is about the 2010 Iraq and Afghanistan war logs and the State Department cables. This is not about 2016, it's not about Sweden, it's about those revelations, and that was work, as most of you know, that was covered on the front pages of the New York Times and Guardian and many international outlets. It won many awards from Amnesty International and others. Now, there's one point I'd like to highlight, which is really interesting, that's come up since Julian's arrest in April of 2019. That I think is really worth highlighting, which is this big shift in discourse and narrative around the case. As we know, Julian tends to be a pretty polarizing figure, but what has now happened is there is a lot of mainstream support for him in this situation, and really mainstream institutional support, be it from human rights groups, from press freedom groups, and from all the leading editorial boards, from the New York Times, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, Freedom of Press Foundation, numerous UN special rapporteurs, and they unanimously oppose these charges and this extradition request because they see it as the gravest threat to press freedom in our lifetimes. So I think it's a really interesting question is, you know, can folks, you know, put or hold personal feelings about the personality and whatever aspects of other pieces of work? And can people focus on these charges and what it means for journalism at large and the sort of opening of the floodgates of the criminalization of journalism? So we'll now open the conversation with Matt and Phil, who've been doing amazing work around highlighting conflicts of interest in this hearing, extradition hearing, that's coming up on September 7th in the UK, in London, so just over 3 months' time, both conflicts of interest with key figures and really amazing inconsistencies. So you can go to Declassify, the website, to find out more. But Matt, would you like to sort of tell us a little bit about what you've been working on?
Sure. So we started in September last year, and early on, one of our earliest stories was about the Assange case. And it's one of those cases when you scratch the surface, you just, all sorts of things unravel. So we started by looking at the husband of the chief magistrate, Lady Arbuthnot, who's made a number of rulings on the Assange case, but is now stepped aside. But we found that her husband was a conservative defense minister. He financially benefited from corporations that had been exposed by WikiLeaks. We then did an investigation of her son, who is a cybersecurity expert and financier and the vice president of a private equity group. And we found that this private equity group was heavily invested in a firm called Darktrace, which was set up by the British intelligence establishment. I mean, they celebrate that fact. They write on their website that we're set up by MI5 and GCHQ veterans. And we just put all the stuff together that was out there. We further found that actually, Lady Arbuthnot herself had benefited from Foreign Office partner organizations who had funded her to go to Turkey and Spain before she was appointed the chief magistrate. So huge conflicts of interest that are really obvious and didn't involve us finding out information that isn't already in the public realm. She has never recused herself in the case, which is irregular in itself, because I've talked to lawyers who have said if there's any hint of conflict of interest, judges will recuse themselves very early on, but she never has. In fact, the only recognition that she stepped aside on the case was a recent article in Private Eye, where the Chief Magistrate Office said that she had stepped aside because of the perception of bias, whatever that means. We didn't get any more information about what that perception of bias was. Now, of course, it would have massive implications for the case if she did formally recuse herself. Number one, because she's made important rulings, which could then be revisited. Number two, because she's still the chief magistrate, which means she has a mentoring role for her junior magistrates, one of which is now ruling on the case. So she was likely involved in appointing Vanessa Bereza, who is now the district judge who's ruling on the case. She was likely involved in appointing her to replace Lady Arbuthnot. She's also involved in conversations, I imagine. That's what it says on the website of the Chief Magistrate's Office. So she's still involved in the case. And there is, and to go to your point about the press and the mainstream and a change in discourse, there has been a change in discourse from freedom of the of press organisations and human rights organisations, definitely. But what we haven't seen is the mainstream media involving themselves in the investigation of the institutions and individuals involved in the trial of Assange. And I mean, we're an alternative media outlet, and the investigations we've done have been shared widely, but no mainstream media has picked up on them. And this is important because actually in the case of Lady Arbuthnot, she made a ruling on Uber some years ago and gave them a license to operate in London. And she had to step aside after The Guardian did an investigation about her husband, who, this is another conflict of interest which applies to the Assange case as well. Her husband, Lord Arbuthnot, was a director of a consultancy called SC Strategy with the former head of MI6, Sir John Scarlett. And that SC Strategy, one of its clients was Qatar. So in the case of Uber, Uber is, a large part of Uber is owned by Qatar. So there was that conflict of interest there. It was in The Guardian, it had an instant impact. In the case of our stories, they've gone round, but they haven't had that instant impact in terms of actually changing the complexion of the case, which they could have if the mainstream media involved themselves. So I think that's the next thing we need to focus on. And we need to get journalists understanding that actually their profession, really the survival of it in the sense that it's existed before, really relies on the outcome of the Assange case. Because if the Assange precedent is set, and if you read the indictment from the DOJ, it really does criminalize national security reporting. Some of the charges in there are just about soliciting leaks, which is day-to-day for most national security reporters and other reporters. So if they get him on that in a country that he was in when he did these alleged crimes, means that the US also has extraterritorial reach, so they can go all around the world, pluck people from any country and bring them into the US if they publish things which the government doesn't like. That's hugely, hugely dangerous. And in my opinion, and I know this may sound verbose, but I think that it is one step along the road to fascism, because I think if you cannot question or reveal the facts about a state that they don't want you revealed, then you're down a slippery slope to all sorts of awful things. So I think, yes, we have mainstream organizations slowly, it has to be said, it's taken them a while, but slowly coming on board. But we need mainstream journalists really looking at this case. Because as I said at the start, if you start scratching the surface, all sorts of things unravel. And more and more, I mean, I'm doing more and more stories about this, which we can talk about. We did a story about the Home Secretary who signed the extradition warrant with the US, Sajid Javid, who had been at five different secretive meetings set up by the American Enterprise Institute. And he was dining and speaking with people who had written articles which were recommending that Assange be whacked and WikiLeaks be shut down physically. So, and again, that story got no mainstream pickup. If it had, it might have been a scandal, because at the time, the shadow Home Secretary, Diane Abbott, was against the extradition of Assange. So the fact that Sajid Javid was in post and has this history is obviously opposite to the case, but again, didn't reach any kind of mainstream, I didn't get any mainstream pickup. So I think what we really need to do is make journalists aware that your future is on the line if you don't get involved now, and don't really reveal the irregularities that this case involves, because really this case should be an open and shut case. He should never, ever be extradited to the US on these charges for all sorts of reasons, which are outlined by mainstream organizations like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch. But because of the irregularities and because of the huge bias involved, I wouldn't be surprised if he does get extradited. So we need to really, really focus on the institutions and the individuals behind this case, and reveal what they're up to.
Just remind folks that the evidence was all available under the Obama DOJ, and they decided not to prosecute. And the Obama DOJ was hardly a friend to whistleblowers or journalists. You know, there were lots of prosecutions, but they worked hard and they could not prosecute Assange because it would be opening the floodgates for the criminalization of journalism. But now under the Trump DOJ, that changed. And so as others like Glenn Greenwald have pointed out, that what, you know, if you're supporting this, you're aligning yourself with the Trump Department of Justice and not the Obama Department of Justice. And it's really interesting the point you made about the sort of the impact of, you know, the Guardian, you know, covering the conflict of interest with the Uber case and the potential to affect this extradition hearing if more journalists, you know, amplify these this work. Phil, do you want to just tell us a little bit about some of the work you've been doing? You've been highlighting some of the sort of inconsistencies in some of your recent work.
Yeah, well, I've been covering some other extradition cases and cases at Westminster Magistrates Court over the last few years. And I think it's quite striking to see how differently Assange's case is being handled. So there's a case that's been going through the British courts for a number of years that involves an Indian airline tycoon, Vijay Mallya. He's an Indian billionaire who fled India amid a financial scandal, all sorts of allegations about financial impropriety in his business affairs. And he resides, he has a residence in the UK. So he came here and the Indian authorities began extradition proceedings against him. And he was arrested by the Met police, like Julian was, but then released on bail and has been on bail ever since. So when I covered the hearings at Westminster Magistrates Court, which Lady Arbuthnot was presiding over, Vijay Mallya would arrive each day in his Range Rover with his entourage, you know, wearing his flashy suits, and journalists would be able to, you know, we'd all crowd around him, ask him questions, take photos, he'd give interviews, his legal team would go in, he'd have lots of time to talk to his lawyers, and while he would sit in the dock, he was physically in the courtroom, he was never handcuffed or restrained, his family were able to watch proceedings, and he's ultimately lost his extradition battle, and it's now just a case of the Home Secretary signing off on his extradition, but he remains on bail and he's not been remanded in any prison, let alone Belmarsh, you know, one of the most high security prisons in the country. So I think that shows the difference. If you're a wealthy billionaire, a business tycoon, you appear to be treated differently in the UK extradition system to a journalist who has investigated and exposed war crimes, including the murder of a Reuters journalist. So I think that really showed to me the double standard that was at play here.
Yeah, that's...
One of the stories we did was about the conditions in which Assange is being held and the irregularity of it. So I got through the Freedom of Information Act a list from the Ministry of Justice of what offences prisoners in Belmarsh were in prison for. And we found that there was nearly 800 inmates, and just two of those were being held for bail violations. So it's hugely irregular that he's been held there. He obviously poses no, he's never been charged with a violent offence. Over a quarter of the inmates in Belmarsh are in there for murder. Then there's paedophilia, rape, all sorts of the worst crimes you can think of. They send them to Belmarsh, but yet Julian Assange, who has never been charged with a violent offence, is in fact charged with journalism, is being held there in conditions that really, really are a risk to his health. I mean, he has a chronic lung condition. And as part of that story, I looked into the old inspector's reports of Belmarsh. And in fact, there's been regular criticisms of Belmarsh for its lack of infection precautions. So it's especially dangerous place there. And the fact he's not being let out during this coronavirus pandemic is hugely, it was outrageous, but it's also hugely irregular. So, and this is a pattern you see again and again throughout this case, is that he's treated in a way that is very irregular. It's not like other people. It's very unique. I mean, even in the case of his bail, the offence, he got 50 weeks for skipping bail, which was nearly the maximum, 52 weeks. And then there's this other guy who was called the motorboat killer, who murdered his, well, he didn't murder, there was an accident on the Thames and his girlfriend died. And he fled to Georgia in Eastern Europe and came back, and he got half the sentence of Assange. That's unexplainable. So I think once you sit people down and get around, try and unpick all the propaganda that they've imbibed over the last decade, they see it. But it's very hard to get around that, because you've had every single, well, all the most powerful intelligence agencies in the world dedicating significant resources over the past 10 years to destroying his reputation. So it's at a stage now where it's actually, you risk something to even defend him. So the facts are very hard to get out. But when you start looking into it, you see that actually this is not a fair trial at all. And from start to finish, it's been irregular. And it's actually a real stain on the British state and the British justice system that they won't live down. I mean, when Edward Snowden tweeted when Assange was grabbed from the embassy by British police, he said something along the lines of this will define Britain's attitude to the free press for generations. And it's true. I mean, that image will live in infamy. So we need to make sure Britain does not become a party to what would be one of the biggest nails in the coffin of the free press that the world has ever seen, maybe the biggest nail in the coffin. So, and for all the people that are watching who live in Britain, you live in the most important jurisdiction for any kind of activism on this topic, because if he goes to the US, he's got no chance. The real chance he has to avoid and his life be saved and avoid extradition is in the UK. So we really need to focus efforts in a run-up to September to expose the irregularities, to expose the bias, and try and get justice.
And just to add to that, could you also touch on the issues in terms of the unfairness of due process and the surveillance in the embassy and the issues around that, and that he didn't have private meetings with his lawyers? Could you just remind us a little bit about that?
Well, it's interesting, actually. When Daniel Ellsberg was on trial for the Pentagon Papers during the Vietnam War, his case was thrown out because it came out that Nixon had ordered a raid on his psychologist's office to try and get information which was embarrassing to Ellsberg. So, of course, that should have happened, and it was right that it happened. Assange has been surveilled, and this has been exposed. He's been surveilled by the CIA. Who had a server that was this Spanish security firm were uploading video and audio of all his meetings with his lawyers and everyone else. That by itself should mean the case is thrown out. It's outrageous that you can have there's no chance you can have a fair trial if the people who are prosecuting have been surveying the defendant as he's been having privileged conversations with his lawyers. It's completely irregular that it hasn't been thrown out on those grounds already. I mean, really is outrageous. And Baltasar Garzon has done great work in Spain in kind of getting these issues out, but it hasn't had an impact in Britain yet. And in fact, there were more irregularities about the British justice system not wanting to hear that evidence from Spain. So, I mean, it's, as I say, it fits into a pattern. And actually the CIA's surveillance of him and trying to get his baby's diaper to get his DNA. I mean, outrageous criminal surveillance. It should be talked about more widely. And in fact, Max Blumenthal did a really amazing piece recently in Grey Zone, which kind of delineated this, the whole history of this. But it was hardly picked up anywhere in the mainstream. I mean, this is what I'm saying. If you look at the facts, devoid of the propaganda of the last decade, you have a journalist resident in London who's a political asylee of a government, a foreign government that's friendly with the UK. And it's revealed that the CIA is spying and trying to take his child's diaper. And yet no one seems to care. El País cover it. But in the UK, no one cares. It hardly figures at all. So we need to break that silence. That is the most important thing we can do. And we need to make journalists become aware that they need to get a bit brave. Because if they don't, then he's going to get sent to the US. He's going to die in prison. And the free press is going to be on the line.
So we've got a couple of questions that pertain to that point. Brendan O'Brien is asking, is it beyond doubt that Assange was bugged in the embassy? And somebody who's going by the name of Tech is asking, why is this case not being reported by the mainstream media, even though it obviously affects them? I would just point folks to, there was a big sign-on letter by international jurists, real international outcry about the bugging of the embassy. There is a case going on about this right now in Spain that, as you say, has been covered by El País and Max Blumenthal. But I don't know if you both want to comment on this. Is it beyond doubt that he was bugged in the embassy? And why is this not being reported by the mainstream media, even though it obviously affects them hugely?
Phil, do you want to go?
Yeah, I think it's such a contrast, right? If you look in outside the UK, papers like El País in Spain and La Repubblica in Italy have done some excellent reporting on the Assange case. When I've been to the Assange hearings in London, I've been struck by the amount of international media that are there. Journalists from Scandinavian countries, from Norway. Obviously, the Australian media follows this case very closely. But when it comes to the British media, there does seem to be this reluctance to cover the case properly. And whilst the hearings get reported, they're kind of given minimal prominence. And also the kind of conflicts of interest behind the case aren't picked up on. And, you know, this case is having a real impact on the UK's press freedom ranking. So Reporters Without Borders, every year they publish a world league table of press freedom. And this year, again, the UK dropped down a couple of places. And one of the main reasons that Reporters Without Borders cited was the Assange case. So now the UK ranks lower than countries like South Africa. So Declassified is published by the Daily Maverick in South Africa. And that's partly because when we were setting up Declassified, we found it hard to find publishers in the UK who wanted to really cover the UK national security state and its foreign and military policies from a critical and objective perspective. So, I mean, we've experienced it ourselves as British journalists trying to do this kind of work in the media industry here. It's really difficult. There is this reluctance among editors to give this case the attention and the coverage that it deserves.
I'd add as well that it's not just that they're not covering it. Many newspapers, particularly The Guardian, were responsible for much of the propaganda, which was a prelude to him being grabbed by the British police. In 2018, The Guardian, obviously, which was formerly a collaborator with Assange on the actual leaks that he's going to be extradited for, or he's on trial for, they ran a series of highly dubious articles for 6 months in 2018, linking Assange with Russia and the Kremlin. And Putin, with very minimal sort of circumstantial evidence, which then obviously the crescendo was the piece about the fake news article about Manafort going to the embassy three times, which they now don't refer to in their articles, tellingly. But they are responsible in many ways for creating the conditions that this could happen. So I think part of it is I don't know if they feel any shame for that. And you would imagine if they felt shame that they'd now go out of their way to try and help him get out of this situation. But I think that the mainstream media have not just been benign, they've been actively conduits for a lot of the interests that want to destroy Assange and destroy WikiLeaks and destroy transparency about foreign policy and about war and all the things that WikiLeaks was set up for. I mean, it's particularly horrible what The Guardian have been doing, because as I said, they were collaborators with Assange, and you would have thought that a paper that benefited in such a real way from the risks he took would then go on to defend him. But in fact, they turned themselves into the biggest attack sheet pretty much in the media. And now you pretty much, the only place that you get interesting or not completely biased articles about Assange and WikiLeaks is the Daily Mail, of all places. And that was the article, that was the place that Assange's partner Stella Morris chose to tell her story about her children with Assange and her relationship with Assange. So that's interesting. So I think there's two things. We need to get the mainstream involved, but we also need to highlight the fact that they were involved in the process, and they should pay some price reputationally about that, because they played a key role in a case that will define for generations the free press.
Can I add to that? You're reminding me, the head of Reporters Without Borders in the UK, Rebecca Vincent, did a discussion, a webinar, with the Assange campaign a few weeks ago, and she made some really interesting comments about asking folks to be open to evolving their positions on the case. And I don't know if she was, you know, sort of saying this to journalists or the media or who it was to, but she was talking about her own journey. And she said she'd been influenced by the US, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, and how he'd evolved. And, you know, he's his verdicts on Assange has been that he's been subjected to psychological torture and he really stands against the extradition. And Rebecca Vincent was saying she too has evolved. And she was really sort of saying to folks, you know, be willing to change how you might have felt about this case 2 years ago, how you might have felt 5 years ago. And she said from all camps, not just folks who've been, you know, and unsympathetic to Assange, but also people on the Assange camp who might be angry with folks who've been responsible for all this campaign against him. And I thought that was a really interesting point for her to raise, that, you know, there's still time. We're 3 months out from the extradition hearing, and there's time to realize how significant this can be. I mean, Margaret O'Sullivan from the Washington Post was talking about this case. You know, she was the public editor at the New York Times, and she was sort of really asking for more mainstream coverage as well. I'm just looking at some of these questions. So I'm going to read another question from Tech saying, if Julian is successfully prosecuted, and the Guardian, Telegraph, or the New York Times later get an embarrassing leak about the US security apparatus, could their journalists then be prosecuted? Do you think the British media, at least in part, are not covering this because they don't like Assange? So whoever would like to take that.
I mean, Phil, you go for it.
Yeah, I think there are personal issues at play here. British journalism is a very small field in terms of the number of personnel involved. And I think a lot of people have made up their minds about Assange, and they're not really willing to look at the wider ramifications. You know, when it comes to press freedom, it shouldn't be about whether or not you like someone, it should be about the principles at stake. And I think there's also, we have this idea that journalists are always easy, you know, in a press freedom campaign, it's always easy to identify who is and who isn't a journalist, and who's worthy of protection and who isn't. But I mean, I've worked on press freedom campaigns in other countries, and there's always often some ambiguities around the journalists involved. There was a case in Bangladesh of a magazine editor who'd been arrested and was being kind of railroaded by the police in Bangladesh. And initially press freedom campaigns were reluctant to support his case because at some point in his career, he'd also done some work with one of the political parties in Bangladesh. So some of the press freedom groups were coming back to me and saying, oh, we're reluctant or unwilling to support him because we think he's more a politician than a journalist. And I'd have to go back to them and say, but look at the charges against him. You know, look at why he's being arrested and put on trial. It's for his journalism. And what precedent will that set for journalism in Bangladesh? So I think this idea that, you know, press freedom campaigns can always revolve around this idea of this kind of perfect journalist who has no personal issues, who has no other kind of political issues. I think that's naive. You know, it's very rare to find a perfect press freedom case. People, you know, no one's perfect. We all bring issues with us. So I think that's clouding people's view on Assange. And I think the most extreme case, of course, is at The Guardian, where you've seen this complete change from, you know, Alan Rusbridger, who really pushed publishing the WikiLeaks material. And in his memoirs, he has, you know, said he would testify in Assange's defense. Whether he will do that or not remains to be seen. But what's happened, particularly since the Snowden leaks, and this is an article that Matt and our editor, Mark Curtis, explored when we launched Declassified, was this kind of transformation of The Guardian from doing quite fearless national security coverage to being incredibly supine and having, I mean, Matt can talk more about this, but having positions on this kind of voluntary self-censorship board that the Ministry of Defence run.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with Phil. I think that it's madness to gauge your reaction to the Assange case on whether you like him or not, because as an individual, he's irrelevant. I mean, obviously, he's a human being, so we should care about his condition and what happens to him. But in terms of the precedent that his extradition will set, that will affect everyone. This is a huge democratic issue. And if in 20 years' time, someone says, "What? Where were you when the Assange precedent was set?" and you say, "Oh, I didn't really get involved because I didn't really like it." I mean, that's not a good excuse, because this will have huge ramifications for a long, long time. So it's great that people are evolving. And I think one of the things we need to do is educate, because the information is so obvious when you start looking into it about the irregularities and about the conditions he's being held in and what he's been held for, that people are often shocked. As you said, the director of Reporters Without Borders, but there's plenty of others that are coming on board now, a lot to do with Nils, and Nils Meltzer is another one of them, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. He said he had huge preconceptions about the case, and when he started looking into it, his views would change radically, and that often happens. And the reason that is because we have this layer of propaganda. As I said, and as Phil talked about, the WikiLeaks revelations were a huge moment in journalism, and The Guardian were very brave to publish them. And in hindsight, Rusbridger was actually a pretty good editor. But what it did was it really upset a lot of very, very dark forces. People in the national security states in the US and the UK do not want transparency. So they will destroy anyone who wants to bring it to them. And that's why we have this massive, we have this process which you talked about, where people come to a realization that they've been lied to, because there's saturation propaganda about the Assange case and about him individually. It's across the media. It's been going on for years. And it's very hard to fight that if you're an activist or you care about press freedom. But education is the way to do it. And I think that more and more people are going to come on side, and I think that's a good thing. And I think if there's enough momentum, it can be turned back. The pressure, I think the mainstream getting involved is a huge moment, because that's what really undermines the case. And I mean, what also needs to be done is highlight the fact, as you said, that this is the Trump administration. This is a far-right administration that does not care at all for press freedom, that would love to see it destroyed. They're the ones who are doing this. The Obama DOJ refused to do it because they didn't want to criminalize the journalism that the New York Times does or the Washington Post. But Trump doesn't care about that. So we have to understand and tell people, look, if they get Assange, it's a victory for the Trump administration against any kind of transparency, against democracy, against press freedom. This is all a victory for Trump. So Assange is really a kind of a signal for everyone that we really need to fight this. And it can be won. I think public opinion is a huge thing in this, and this is why so much, so many resources have been put into demonizing him and making it a personal issue, because they want to get people away from the facts. They don't want people to look into the case and look into what he's tried for, to read the indictment from Trump to DOJ. They don't want that. What they want to do is they want people to read some article they've planted in the newspaper that makes him look like an arrogant rapist or whatever the smear of the day is. So, yeah.
Yeah, this leads to a question, an interesting question from Karen Hemming. If the New York Times, Guardian and Der Spiegel published, why aren't they being prosecuted? Why the double standard? And can I just add before we answer that, I do think it's interesting how you have all these viral moments from the Trump press conferences where, you know, he's rude to a journalist, then it goes viral and it's, you know, gets so much attention. Yet when it comes to what many have described, you know, top lawyers around the world have described as the gravest threat to press freedom in our lifetime, it's not getting the coverage. I think Bernie said in one of the debates, Bernie Sanders said he would commit to not use the Espionage Act to prosecute journalists. And I think there's a movement right now in process, it's not out yet, but I think there's a campaign to push Biden, should he win the election, to commit to drop the prosecution and to, you know, go with the sort of Obama DOJ stance on this. But anyway, going back to Karen Hemming's question, why aren't the Times, Guardian and Der Spiegel being prosecuted? Why the double standard? Why are they going after Julian? I mean, I think you've partially answered it, but maybe you can comment on that.
Phil? Well, it's up to you.
I think it's purely tactical, isn't it? If they took on the New York Times and Der Spiegel and the Guardian in a kind of full frontal offensive, the whole of the media would rally around those institutions and defend them, and the case wouldn't, you know, be laughed out of court. They're going after Julian because they see WikiLeaks as the weak link. They see it as an organization whose reputation they have been able to attack over the last decade, to the point now where people forget about what this case actually centers on, and, you know, the revelations that WikiLeaks did around things like the murder of a Reuters journalist by the US military in Iraq. And they think that they can have the same effect by going after one man. But the precedent will affect, ultimately, the Guardian, New York Times, Der Spiegel. So they'll get what they want in the end, but they're just doing it through a much more, from their point of view, kind of the path of least resistance. And that's what it is, literally, the path of least resistance, because look how little, particularly in the UK, how little pushback there has been to what they're trying to do.
It's worth adding as well that journalism is all about leaks from people within the system. So it happens every day that General Petraeus leaked classified information to his lover, and he didn't go to prison. People within the security state in the US and the UK leak to favoured journalists all the time, but it's information that they control and makes them look good. What Julian Assange did was leak information that exposes the truth about what they do. It wasn't part of a disinformation operation that they were running. So that is the real crime that he did. He flipped how they think journalism should be done. And I mean, there's been tons of work done on the role that the security services play within journalism in the US and the UK, and it's extensive. So what Julian Assange did really upended that, and he's being punished for that.
We've got a question from Tech asking, are you at Declassified nervous that this could happen to you? And I would add to that, could you make a comment on this? This is a US extradition request for an Australian citizen who's in the UK. Can you speak to what this means for international journalists? If this can happen, in this situation, what does it mean? What could, you know, a Modi government extradition request look like? A Netanyahu extradition request look like? What does this mean in terms of international journalism and the risks between different states?
How does this make sense? I can go if you want.
Yeah.
I think it's maybe the most important point is the extraterritorial reach that it gives the US. And if they successfully extradite him, what's to say the Saudi regime can't extradite us if we do a story that they don't like about their military or their national security state? So it's a hugely worrying development. And we don't know how it will develop, because often how these things start is they pick someone that is hugely unpopular. So there's very few defenders of them. And then once the precedent is set, they start using against everyone. And national security reporting is one of the big chinks in our armor of the state of the US and the UK states, because in the information age, it's much harder for them to control what gets out. So there's been they've schemed for decades now about how they can criminalize effectively national security reporting. And there was a report that was commissioned by the UK government a couple of years back about national security reporting, about the Official Secrets Act. And one of the recommendations was that handling classified information should be a crime, which would criminalize the journalist end of a leak, which has never happened really. And that's something again that's established in the Assange case, because throughout history, whistleblowers have been treated awfully and been prosecuted under the Espionage Act. But that's kind of standard. That's happened all the way through. Journalists haven't really, except it started in a big way under Obama, and it's picking up massively. And I think that's the next fault line that will be crossed, because they want to disrupt that flow of information from principled whistleblowers to journalists. They can't stop whistleblowers, but they can threaten journalists and make the risk very high for them to start publishing this stuff. So I think we're going to see more and more of that. And the Assange case is a massive part of that whole process, and they're rolling it out across the world.
And just, you know, we were talking a little bit, you know, about the impact that The Guardian has had in other cases. You know, how they worked with WikiLeaks on these Iraq blogs. And just to remind everyone that the former editor, Alan Rusbridge, has come out strongly in editorials saying that this is outrageous, that he strongly condemns the extradition requests and the charges should be dropped. So that has appeared, I think he's written at least two pieces about that. And he's been, you know, very strong about that. The New York Times as well, and the Telegraph has had a positive editorial as well. And actually, I forgot to mention, there was a question in Parliament to Boris Johnson about the extradition treaty more generally, not about this case. And Boris Johnson himself, a former journalist, actually said that he thought the treaty was lopsided and it warranted more review, right? So. And I think the Conservative MP David Davis actually mentioned that, was it something like 135 Brits have gone to the US, but only is it 9 Americans have come this way. So it's a very unbalanced treaty itself, let alone all the other due process violations that the UN and many other groups have come out to highlight. I mean, I think we'll start to wrap this up unless there are any other burning questions. Let me see. Oh, there might be some burning questions, but I'm just going to have a quick. There are quite a few. What I might ask is, maybe could you both do just some sort of closing comments in terms of what you're asking of the public, in terms of, you know, amplifying your work and encouraging the media to dig into this more, because, you know, we only have, what, 3 months before September 11th, September 7th, for the extradition hearing in the UK. Oh, and can I just throw up one more question that's come up a few times in terms of Judge Arbuthnot? Can you just clarify what you meant by stepped aside? She hasn't formally recused herself, but she's stepped aside. Can you just touch on that again?
So she never, the court never announced that she had stepped aside. So there was a lot of speculation, but it had never announced it. And then there was an article in Private Eye some months back where they released a statement which said she had stepped aside. And what that means is that she no longer rules on the case, but she hasn't formally recused herself, which would mean that, which would have ramifications legally. So stepping aside means her old ruling stands. She just won't make any ones going forward, and she still can maintain a role in the case. So it's kind, and also she said she was stepping aside because of a perception of bias. She didn't say that there was any bias, which is, I mean, when you start looking into the evidence of huge conflicts of interest, the fact she was funded by partner organisations of the UK Foreign Office, which has called Assange a miserable little worm, and amongst loads of others, the fact that she hasn't said there is any bias is a red flag, in my opinion. So she's flagged the perception of bias, which means she, as I say, can maintain a role. It's kind of a get out, and they haven't even, I don't know if they've discussed it with Assange's lawyers, but it in terms of it coming into the public realm, it hadn't come out until this article in Private Eye. So it's basically the distinction is stepping aside means you can, has different legal ramifications to recusing yourself.
So perhaps you might share some sort of final thoughts and what your sort of call to actions would be. And then I'll make some final comments about the Don't Extradite Assange campaign, which has some specific actions like petitions and letters to MPs that you can sign on to. But Phil, would you like to go ahead?
Yeah, I think it's great. So many people have joined this webinar this evening. That's really exciting. And it's great to talk more about the work we've been doing at Declassified. I know Matt is still digging into the case, and hopefully in the next few weeks and months, there'll be some more revelations about the kind of procedural irregularities around the Assange extradition case. So keep your eye on the Declassified website and also on our social media channels. And also, I think while it can be quite depressing that the state of the UK media, we are trying to do something a bit different at Declassified, along with other kind of new media and alternative media platforms, to create a bit more of a space for different ways of looking at the world and more objective coverage of issues that kind of the corporate media bring their own biases to. So that's what we're trying to do.
I would just say everyone needs to allow themselves to go along the route that Susie was talking about earlier, which is from anti-Assange position to understanding that the case is so heavily propagandized that you need to get the information yourself. You cannot rely on the media to understand what is happening. So from the beginning, he's been demonized by the press. From the beginning, the legal process has been hugely irregular. But yet, if you live out in society and don't check alternative media or other ways of getting information, you wouldn't know any of this stuff. So my message is, educate yourself. Don't trust what you're reading in the papers. Don't trust what you're seeing on TV, because you're not getting the truth. Look at the case yourself. And a lot, and I mean, people should get involved in investigating, because a lot of this stuff is out there. And citizen reporters can do this stuff. I've used things that are freely available on the internet to find a lot of these stories. So for example, the UK Foreign Office partner organizations, that was on Lord Arbuthnot's Register of Interests, which anyone can find online. So all this stuff is out there. And this is, we need to understand that this is a David versus Goliath fight. You have the whole establishment. Every element of the establishment wants to get Assange because he exposed them. And then on the other side, you have one man who had nothing but a laptop, and he's exposed huge crimes, probably more than any journalist in the history of the world. So when you have that battle, think about what side you want to be on. Think whether you want to be on the side of the man who exposed the elite, or all these former conservative defense ministers, these establishment judges, these national security officials, these war criminals. You don't want to be on the side of them. You want to be on the side of the guy that exposed them. So get active and understand that this is a fight that will define your freedom for generations. Because if they get Assange, it criminalizes your ability to expose what the state does in your name, which is hugely dangerous. And we need to be very wary of that.
Yeah, well, thank you both for your extraordinary work. I mean, as you said the other day, I think, you know, people in years to come, depending on how this goes, will be like, what were you doing? Did you set this out because, oh, you know, it was a bit controversial, or did you actually do something? And I think what I find so exciting about your work is there's a ton to dig into. This is not a done deal. We're 3 months out, and just looking at the work you both have done in terms of the egregious conflicts of interest and inconsistencies, there's a lot to be exposed and to be amplified between the surveillance of his legal meetings, you know, the psychological torture, the doctor's letter, the jurist letter, and then, as we've said, all these, you know, editorial boards and press freedom and human rights groups that have come out vehemently against this. You know, it's an interesting point, and it would be amazing if this could be a turning point. You know, we're in an incredibly depressing news cycle, but we have a few months to try and do something. So I hope folks on this call, thank you, you've all had amazing comments and questions. I hope you will be remain super engaged and get even more involved. You know, people have been raising great questions. Can we get Private Eye involved? All these things. So I think, I'm sure we'll all be digging in and just seeing what else can be done. But thank you.
Thank you.
So this will be recorded, so we can share this and then dig into the graphics. And just to remind you that the Don't Extradite Assange campaign, you can see all the quotes, the statements, the letters. I mean, it's an impressive collection. So you can find all the resources there. So thanks very much, everyone, for joining us.